Okay, this is gonna be a big one. We've got a couple of awesome guests, big topics to get to. Over the course of the next hour, we're gonna be talking about climate change. Beto O'Rourke has received some pressure over his recent statements on climate change, his new plan. Many people felt it did not go far enough. He has responded, and we will evaluate how good that response is. At the end of the show, I, like virtually everyone in the country, just watched Knock Down the House, the new documentary covering the candidacies of AOC, Amy Vilela, Paul Jean Swearengen, and Cori Bush. And I'm gonna give my thoughts to close out the show on that because it was a powerful documentary. And we've also got Joanna Piacenza of Morning Consult is gonna join us to talk about what the American people think about political correctness, what they say about it and what they think about it, and how those two things do not necessarily line up in the way that you would expect. And then later on the show, Sarah Kendzior is gonna be joining us once again to respond to the Barr testimony yesterday, the lack of testimony today, what consequences there should be for that, and what the Democrats should do in regard to Donald Trump going forward towards the 2020 election. But before we get to all of that, I'm going to do something we never do in the beginning of the show. I'm gonna talk about The View, the bad things they do, and also the things that they don't do that they're being blamed for over the course of the next 10 minutes or so. But first of all, at some point last week when Bernie Sanders was talking about the possibility of not only making sure that everyone who has paid their debt to society in prison and has now gotten out should be allowed to vote, but that also they should be allowed to vote while they're in prison, that created some controversy that continues to today. And at the time, The View talked about it. I actually missed their discussion about it. And there's some interesting stuff in this short clip that I wanna show you. So here is Meghan McCain on what Bernie Sanders had been proposing.
I think
he should be given the death penalty. I mean, that's where I'm at with this. People commit acts of terror on American soil.
Does this include in your mind domestic terrorists?
Yes, terrorism is terror. Yes, of course.
And what about those guys who shoot schools up?
They should, of course, be in jail. Child molesters. I'm trying to tell you, what Bernie Sanders said is going to be turned into a clip that will be. It upset me this morning.
How do you feel about the fact that people in Vermont are allowed to vote in prison.
And I didn't have brothers that served multiple times, and I didn't watch my brother deploy when he was 19 to fight this crap, to have them come here and give the right to vote.
Okay, so like four things. First of all, that is a daytime show, and yet it is the most exhausting TV to watch imaginable. I don't know how they make it through a full show that's just yelling back and forth, but I wanna focus on what Meghan McCain was saying there. Before we get to the voting, I think this is peak Meghan McCain, where she has been over the past couple of weeks, as there's been all this violence towards both in the US and internationally against synagogues, she's been weirdly making it about herself. And now the fact that she has relatives who have served abroad, she deployed that exactly how a person who had themselves served would deploy it. That is like family stolen valor. I did not have someone else fight abroad so that this would happen today. That's not actually how it works. If you want to deploy that, by the way, you could have a problem with that sort of rhetorical flourish, even if a person was doing it themselves, but she did not serve, okay? And I did not have lots of other people serve so that Meghan McCain could steal valor in this way. Anyway, so that's just Meghan McCain. She's one of the most important voices in American politics because we live in America, it's 2019. Far more important though is the voting. And so she's responding to Bernie Sanders. Here is just a little bit of what Bernie Sanders said at the time. I believe even if they're in jail, they're paying their price to society, but that should not take away their inherent American right to participate in our democracy. And now it might seem weird, like you might say, well, John, you've been talking about this for a week now, you've talked about it multiple times, why now with The View? Well, the thing is, for whatever reason, The View is an incredibly popular show that is very important in American political discourse. All the presidential candidates have to go there. The things that they opine on make news virtually every day, which is why it's so frustrating when they give people like Meghan McCain a spot on the panel. But that's what we've got. And so I do want to respond to some of it because again, every time I talk about this topic, I am realizing more and more that this is a hill to die on and I'm just going to die. And that there is just something fundamental that is not going to allow people to engage fully in a logical fashion on the argument that all of these people should be allowed to vote. Because the conversation has been hijacked. It has been hijacked in exactly the way I predicted, literally as Cuomo was asking the question about the Boston bomber to Bernie Sanders. The goal was to hijack it and it has been thoroughly hijacked. And to demonstrate that, let's talk about numbers just a little bit. So you probably know that we have the largest prison population per capita. We have literally millions of American citizens at any given time that are locked up. It is a massive, massive population. Of that population, how many of those people are the Boston bomber? Don't worry about running the numbers, I'll do it for you. It's the one guy. And in terms of terrorists more broadly and domestic terrorists and all of that, even defining that very loosely, we'll include all of the people who do the mass shootings, all of that. Is that 1 in 10,000 of the people in prison? Is it 1 in 50,000? I honestly don't know. I looked for the numbers and couldn't find them, but it is small. And yet, that's all the conversation we're having about this. I will even go more broad than just the terrorists, because I have a feeling that even if we weren't talking about the Boston bomber, people would still have a problem with the idea that someone who committed murder or someone who committed rape or something like that was going to be allowed to vote. So all of that, let's include all the violent crimes, all the rape, everything like that, even violent robberies that don't result in a murder or anything like that. The numbers, it's like 15% of the prison population, which I don't think most people know. I think most people learn about prison through TV and movies and think that the prisons are just filled with violent criminals. Now, there are a good number. That's certainly the case. But something like 80 to 85% have not done anything violent. They're in there for a number of other crimes. And you probably know that the single biggest category are nonviolent drug offenses. It's like something like 45% for the numbers that I saw earlier today. So when we want to have a conversation about millions of Americans having the ability to more fully participate in American democracy, we don't have that conversation. We have a conversation about, at best, whether 10% of those people should be allowed to vote, and honestly, whether 1 or 2 of those people should be allowed to vote. So if there are tons of people who've been thrown in jail for nonviolent drug offenses, and let's keep it real, in many cases because of the implicit discrimination, bias, and unjust nature of our criminal justice system, forget that, Ted Kaczynski's out there. And do we really want him to vote? And we've gone through all this, it's probably a waste of time to do it again, but first of all, what do we think that those people are going to do with their vote? The handful of people that are the worst examples of what that they would be allowed to vote. What do we think is going to be the consequences of their democratic participation? And how do we think that it is so bad that it should necessarily rule out millions of other people being allowed to vote when they haven't committed any crimes, anything like that small handful of people? And also, as many people have pointed out, if our prison population is so large that we're worried that they could single-handedly throw elections to some sort of other criminal or something like that, maybe we should deal with that problem as well. Okay, maybe that's something we should prioritize as a society. And again, I just want to reiterate this over and over and over again, because I didn't watch the full View segment. I have a feeling Meghan McCain did not make this point. A lot of people don't know this. But I've been reading, I've been doing research. Did you know that some people in prison didn't actually commit the crimes they're in there for? Did you know that going back to the beginning of our country, there have been certain types of people that are more likely to be thrown in prison when they didn't actually commit the crime? Did you know that people serve decades and then eventually, thanks to things like the Innocence Project, are released from prison? And that entire time, when they were unjustly deprived of every right, one of which being able to vote, they could have at least had some impact on what was going on, maybe actually voting in a way that could have resulted in some sort of representation that would take the threat of people being locked up unjustly more seriously and do something about it. But we don't allow even that. And so again, the view segment from April 24th that we just played is just such a perfect example of how a larger conversation that could be grounded in a bigger conversation about making sure that we have a vibrant democracy that more and more people are participating in, instead has become a wasted opportunity because some people have made it about the Boston bomber or whatever, 1 or 2 other people. And Meghan McCain just jumps in that. That is the only thing that she wants to talk about. If we were to compile a list of the political priorities of Meghan McCain, and we were to just start listing things, at what point would we get to making sure that as many Americans as possible can actually vote? And yet that conversation makes it seem as if that's a thing that she is really thinking about, and she's just come out on the other side of the issue. But that's not what I actually believe is going on. And it's really frustrating that this seems like a conversation that we're not going to have. That other people that might have been inclined to push for something like this, they're going to be scared off from it because of the conversations going on in places like The View. And that is very depressing. Now, perhaps more importantly, Tucker Carlson apparently very worried about white supremacists getting radicalized in America. But we might have a bit of a disagreement about who exactly is radicalizing them, as you'll see.
But isn't it time to stop with the racism and the white privilege stuff, attacking people on the base of their skin color? Could we just call it truce and just not talk like that anymore?
Sincerely, I wish we could, but what we've been seeing under this president is a rise in white domestic terrorism, a rise in white nationalism.
You have to attack white people?
I think it's the opposite, actually. I think what we're seeing is that people like Dylann Roof are getting more radicalized right now under our president.
And so when you have The View being like, even if you're really poor, we hate you because of your skin color. You don't think that radicalizes people? Maybe a little bit?
And just bear in mind, he's one of the smart ones. He's one of the ones that's, he's a more serious Republican. Like, he's willing to question, the elites in society and all that. No. So he's worried about the radicalization, but who is radicalizing those white supremacists? The View. Okay, so it's Meghan McCain, I guess, and Abby Huntsman and all the rest. They're the ones that are doing it. So there's so many absolute BS points in that I will say. And didn't say it. And so came close, okay? This is what Tucker Carlson does to me. So can we call a truce? So you have two things, because in American political discourse, you have two things that you contrast. So you have American racism, both in the present and institutionalized racism going back literally hundreds of years. And now we have people talking about white privilege. Can we call a truce? Why are you attacking Americans? Well, you see, the thing is, I talk about white privilege and I acknowledge it. And I don't really feel like I'm attacking myself. Don't feel like I'm hitting myself. I feel like it's an important thing for us to talk about in America. But we're not going to convince them of that. So we're going to move on. So I will just say that it is not only absurd that Tucker Carlson is saying that it is The View that is radicalizing white supremacists, who are, by the way, going into black churches and shooting up people and synagogues and shooting up people and all of that. It's also incredibly convenient, because if there is any high-profile media figure that appears to be doing whatever he can with whatever power he has to radicalize more and more white nationalists and white supremacists in America, it would certainly have to be Tucker Carlson. And I just want to go through just a couple quick pieces of the evidence. You're familiar with most of this, I'm sure, but you might pick up just a little bit. Derek Black is the son of the founder of Stormfront.org, one of the big original websites for white supremacists. And he said recently, "It's really, really alarming that my family watches Tucker Carlson's show once and then watches it on the replay because they feel that he is making the white nationalist talking points better than they have. And they're trying to get some tips on how to advance it." So those who, for much more than a decade, were running a white supremacist website feel like they can learn things from Tucker Carlson in making the case that white supremacy is awesome and that's the direction we should be going in. And how does he actually do this? What are some of the talking points? Well, here's a quick rundown. In August of last year, Carlson ran an erroneous segment about white farmers in South Africa pushed off their land, a conspiracy theory widely circulated in far-right circles. It's part of the white genocide argument. Carlson has objected to the removal of Confederate statues, defended the social network Gab, which has been described as Twitter for racists. And in December 2018, he claimed that immigrants are making America, quote, dirtier, for which he lost some of his sponsors. In February, the white nationalist site VDare thanked Carlson for name-checking them in a segment about deplatforming. Tucker Carlson simply called them a publication, not a white supremacist publication. And in March, leaked chat messages of the white nationalist group Identity Europa show that members believe, quote, Tuck is our guy and has, quote, done more for our people than most of us could ever hope to. But lest you come away from this video just thinking that he is parroting their talking points, no, he's also using the literal racist language that they would use as well. Thanks to Media Matters, we know that Tucker Carlson described Iraqis as, quote, semi-literate primitive monkeys in past comments made on the Bubba the Love Sponge radio show. So he believes these things, he says these things, and he makes sure that the millions of people who watch his show on a nightly basis are being fed a steady diet of white nationalists and white supremacist talking points. But don't worry, it's probably Whoopi. It's probably Whoopi and Abby Huntsman and all the rest. Joy Behar, she is the one that is pushing white supremacists into shooting up places of worship because she acknowledges white privilege and racism. But just to make sure, I'm not an expert on this, totally acknowledge that. The head of the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence project, Heidi Byrick, said, Tucker Carlson probably has been the number one commentator mainstreaming bedrock principles of white nationalism in this country, which is fear of immigrants, fear of Muslims, keeping them out, and arguing that whites are under attack. And when you bear in mind all of those different elements that Heidi just mentioned there, you will find them in a couple of different places. You will find them in the manifestos of white supremacists who commit terrorism acts, and you'll find them in the nightly rundowns of Tucker Carlson on his Fox News show. So, Maybe a little bit less worry about The View in that regard, although there are perfectly worrisome things about the show that I point out on a daily basis. They're probably not the ones causing the white supremacist radicalization. With that, we are going to take a break. We come back, a big poll from Morning Consult on political correctness. What do the American people really believe? We'll be breaking that down after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Political correctness is about as loaded a term as any in American political discourse. And so to learn a little bit more about it, I would like to welcome to the show Joanna Piacenza of Morning Consult. Joanna, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm terrible, but I'm hoping to learn something from you. We're talking about American politics, so I'm in a bad way. But Morning Consult recently did a quite in-depth survey about what Americans think about political correctness and related terms and what it really means to them. Because we talk about it, I think, in a fairly shallow way a lot of the time. Sure. So before we dig down deep, what are some of, in your view, the key takeaways from the Morning Consult poll?
Kind of the big headline takeaways is the anti-PC crowd kind of cries over free speech have very little to do with the words they can and can't say and are more strongly rooted in perceptions of discrimination and privilege.
Interesting. Okay, so you attempted to differentiate, I saw in one part of the poll, between people identifying whether or not they themselves abide by some form of political correctness and whether in reality they actually do. And so I found that to be very interesting. So what was the result of that section?
Well, one of the questions was, it was a split sample, which means that we asked half the respondents one question, half the respondents another. And just 34% of people said, yes, I identify as politically correct. But if you actually take away the term and just describe it, that number doubles. It's more than 70% of people essentially follow the rules of what it means to be politically correct, but about a third only consider themselves to be politically correct.
Interesting. And so when you break down different areas that people might want to talk about, how free they feel to express their true views on this, it turned out that they did not feel as free on different categories. So what are some of the things that they felt that they needed to be more politically correct on versus the opposite?
So this was really interesting. This whole survey was kind of inspired from a common polling question where you asked, is there too much prejudice in the country or is there too much political correctness in the country? And we were really interested in the too much PC crowd. So we put together the giant 13,000 plus poll, and we found that most people, including those who say there's too much prejudice, agreed with statements such as the rules about what you can and can't say, you know, change every day and it's hard to keep up. The current climate prevents people from talking about how they really feel about certain topics. When you ask them about certain hot button issues, race, immigration, sexuality, gender, most people, including those who say there's too much PC, said they do feel like they're able to talk about all of these issues in a way that's authentic to how they feel. So people have a really complicated relationship with PC. Maybe they say that Other people can't talk about it, but yes, I can say how I really feel about this certain thing.
So just out of curiosity, I mean, you broke down in the poll different groups, how likely they are to say that there's too much political correctness versus too much prejudice and all of that. If you were to have to identify sort of the prototypical example of a person who is worried about political correctness in America, what might that person look like?
The people who said that there's too much political correctness are disproportionately white. They are disproportionately male, Republican, conservative, and supportive of Trump. They're actually disproportionately white and male. It's 47% of people who say that there's too much political correctness are white men, compared to just 37% of the whole population.
So I apologize if this goes outside of the specific questions in your poll just a little bit, but this is something I've been interested in for a long time, because if you were to ask someone to define what political correctness is, I think that they would give you a definition that hypothetically could be applied to behavior or speech of anyone on any sort of end of the political spectrum. And yet I have noticed in practice that it only really is used in reference to sort of more liberal or left-wing attempts to use terms that are considered to be politically correct. So about a week ago, when people were referring to those who had been killed in the terrorist attacks on Easter as Easter worshippers instead of Christians, a lot of right-wingers were very angry about that. But I don't think many of them would have said that the people saying Easter worshippers aren't being politically correct. In your work, have you found any indication that there is this sort of political bias in what gets labeled as political correctness and what doesn't?
Republicans were, that's an interesting question, because, you know, you see in a lot of entertainment, Christians being made fun of, whites being made fun of, Trump supporters being poked at on TV shows and in films. But I could see, you know, some of these people who say there's too much political correctness saying, well, wait, I can't say what I used to be able to say 10 or 20 years ago about immigrants, about women with the Me Too movement, about any racial or ethnic minority group. So there's this kind of sentiment of unfairness. How come we can make fun of Christians? How come we can make fun of whites, of veterans on SNL, but we can't make fun of these groups that 10, 20, 30 years ago we could make fun of?
Yeah, and I guess you sort of got into it there, but in one of the write-ups about this poll I saw, it certainly seems as if a lot of the concerns seem to be less about free speech, especially as you point out, these people do in fact feel like they can still say those things, and more about some sort of sense of victimhood, of having lost something. Does that seem accurate?
Absolutely. There's kind of this sense of martyrdom. In terms of those who said that there's too much prejudice, they were three times, that group who said there's too much prejudice, they were three times as likely as the group who said there's too much political correctness to say that discrimination, racism, and sexism aren't taken seriously enough. Mm. If you look at the party breaks, we kind of looked at the two groups, too much political correctness and too much prejudice. But if you look at the party breaks, Republicans are more likely to say that black people do not understand the advantages they have than they are to say white people do not understand the advantages they have, I think by a 3-to-1 margin.
Wow. Joanna Piacenza, features editor for Morning Consult, thank you again for joining us today.
Of course, lots more to see in that data package, so take a look.
So we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, a little update on Better Works climate proposal. We'll give you the bit of finessing that's gone on over the past day after this. Very briefly, I just want to say a little bit more about what we've been talking about over the past two blocks, where we had Tucker Carlson in the A block, and then we had the interview about political correctness in the B block. It's not totally a coincidence. I really do want just to have it in the back of your mind as you're going forward, and as you're listening to the arguments that people on different ends of the political spectrum make. Just think about when you hear political correctness deployed, when it's used and when it's not used. Because we were talking in the A block about how Tucker Carlson wants a truce. He doesn't want to hear about white privilege. He doesn't want to hear accusations that someone is a racist. He thinks that those things are bad and offensive and politically incorrect. He would never say that. He would never identify it as that. But that is clearly what he is saying. We gave the example in the B block of the Easter worshippers. Like, there are terms, specific terms they don't like to see deployed against them. They get really, really angry about that as well. And yet, not political correctness. Political correctness is just a thing that leftist snowflakes use. Everybody's concerned about terminology, but it's only the leftists who are politically correct. And so just bear that in mind as we go forward. But we here at the Damage Report are gonna go forward. Beto O'Rourke released just a couple of days ago his climate change plan, and it was criticized from a lot of people, including AOC, myself, the Sunrise Movement. And I think in response to that widespread criticism, he has actually responded at least a little bit. And here he is, he's gonna give us a little video excerpt about one of the changes he's making in response.
Wanted to let you know that I've signed the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge. And I've done it in large part because I was asked to by students that I met at William and Mary when I was in Virginia. Students, young people, activists, and advocates that I've met all over the country who understand that we don't take PAC money, we don't accept help from corporations or lobbyists or special interests. But given the enormity of our challenge right now to ensure that we keep this planet from warming 2 degrees over pre-industrial revolution levels because of the fires, the droughts, the floods, the cost in human life that that will produce, and that we need everybody on board to meet this challenge head on. We don't want there to be any real or perceived conflicts of interest. So in accordance with the pledge, we've returned any money we've received over $200 from any fossil fuel company executives. We will not take that money going forward. And we continue to try to be the largest grassroots campaign in this country. All human beings, all fellow Americans, all focused on the same goals, including confronting climate change before it is too late.
Okay, so that is a good change. Credit to him for responding in a significant way. As with all politicians, and in particular with Beto O'Rourke, when it comes to these sorts of financial promises, we do have to make sure that they are not exploiting loopholes. That has happened in the past, it's happening right now for some people, so we have to watch for that. But this is a good change, because it's one thing to make a minor change to a plan that will, best case scenario, be presented in a year and a half. It's another thing to reject the money today. That is, that's a more concrete thing. And so, good on Beto O'Rourke for doing that. I still think though, like what he was talking about, the way he was describing the threat of climate change and what we need to do to do something about it was great. I loved it. And yet in his plan on Monday, he still said that we should be aiming for net zero carbon emissions by 2050, which we know is not what the scientists around the globe are saying we need to do. And so I want your rhetoric to be reflected in your plan. And so far we don't have that yet. But again, a little bit of credit. And so I want to give you an updated response from the Sunrise Movement when he released that video. They said, for decades, fossil fuel billionaires have knowingly impeded action on climate change and used their massive wealth to mislead the public about one of the most pressing crises of our time. Beto deserves credit for acknowledging the toxic role of fossil fuel money in politics, and we commend him for swearing off those donors. We hope every single candidate for president realizes they will not be perceived as credible with our generation unless they do the same. And thankfully, when it comes to the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, many candidates have signed on. I think over 140 overall, including most of the people running for president. So much so that I'm not gonna read the list of those who are signed on to it. I'm gonna read the list of those who are not yet so that we can put pressure on them. As of right now, presidential contenders who have not signed the pledge include Joe Biden. You probably haven't heard about him, but you'll hear more about him in the future. Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Tim Ryan, Julian Castro, John Delaney, and John Hickenlooper. They're making Johns look bad. Okay, I'm one John who will not take fossil fuel money. Unfortunately, most of those running for president will right now. So that's eight of the pretty big ones and some small ones who need to sign on to this pledge. And I will say for Beto O'Rourke, I think that he's really wasting an opportunity here. I understand he's from Texas. That provides some significant restraints in terms of, or like incentives not to attack the fossil fuel industry because they're all over the place there. But it's like, it's one thing to not take the money. But for us to actually get to where we need to be, I want a candidate who is going to say, I've got a bottle of champagne chilling in the fridge, and when we shut down the last fracked gas well, I will pop that bottle of champagne. When there is not even one car running on internal combustion, that will be a day to celebrate in America. When we shut down the last coal plant, like to actually say, I don't want your money, and in fact, your industry is killing us, and we're going to kill your industry. That's what we actually need to get to where we need to be. And right now, we don't have candidates who are willing to say that, who are willing to say, not only am I not going to take your support, but I am your enemy, and I will win because of the strength of the movement behind me. And hopefully very soon, we will get to that place. Okay, we are going to take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Okay, before we jump back into the news, I did want to let you know that if you are not already watching our Sunday reviews of Game of Thrones, which happen immediately after the episode airs, you need to be doing that. We're having so much fun with it. The conversations have been raucous. There's been big disagreement. They've been long, as these episodes demand. And so we are going to be doing another one this week. Now, some of it is going to be streaming live, toat.com/live, but the predictions for future episodes section is for members only. And so if you're not already a member, you can become one by going to toit.com/John and taking part. We read comments and answer questions from the fans during that. And it's a ton of fun. I believe this week is going to be myself, Brett, I think Brooke, and Ben. It is? I think it is, yes. And so that's going to be so much fun. So if you're not already a member, toit.com/John, you can take part in that. Oh, we also do a lot of content about news and politics, so that's fun too. It's mostly Game of Thrones, some news and politics. Anyway, with that, let's talk about news of the day. William Barr testified before the Senate yesterday. He was supposed to testify before the House today, and they decided, nope, we're not going to do that. We're not going to take part. Honestly, I'm surprised that he did what he did yesterday. It was rough for him. He came out looking like a complete partisan hack. He fulfilled all of our worst predictions about what sort of AG he would be if he was allowed to take the position months ago. And that is exactly who he was. He did not sit before the Senate yesterday as the Attorney General, as the top law enforcement officer of our country. He sat there as Donald Trump's personal lawyer. He responded to every question with Donald Trump and the White House's talking points. He spun nonsensical ideas of what obstruction of justice is and isn't. He lied about the fact that there needs to be some sort of underlying crime that's been discovered. And in one section that I thought about showing the video, but we showed a lot of video from it yesterday. He talked about how if the president feels that an investigation is predicated on like a false accusation, then there is nothing wrong with him literally shutting down the entire thing. And again, when pressed, he would never give any example of what evidence it was a false accusation would be. He would never explain how we would differentiate between an actual ethical president worrying about his presidency being hampered and shutting down an investigation and some sort of would-be despot shutting down any accountability whatsoever for crimes he committed. There was no concern over that whatsoever. And so my worry is that while I think many of the people who watched the testimony yesterday came away with a little bit more respect for Kamala Harris because she did a great job, and the full knowledge that William Barr is just there to protect the president, some will perhaps buy into the narratives that he was spinning. Some of the headlines will have seemed sort of good for Donald Trump. Obviously, the coverage of it last night on Fox News was glowing. Sean Hannity was a massive fan. He said that on a scale of 1 to 10, Lindsey Graham and William Barr deserved 1,000. And that's what they get for just lying. And that's my concern. Now, we move to today. Yesterday, we had him in the Senate. Today was supposed to be the House, and he didn't take part. Now, in response to that, he could end up in prison, hypothetically. The Democrats had said in advance of this that if he did not come in, that he would be held in contempt. Do you believe that he actually will? Do you believe that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer will wail at him with the hammer of God? I don't think so. I have a feeling that he's probably going to be just fine. And that really does worry me because this comes after a couple of weeks where Donald Trump and the White House have made clear that they have no intention whatsoever of cooperating with any investigation. We're talking about things directly derived from the Mueller report and things that have nothing to do with the Mueller report. We're never a part of that investigation. They're not going to be sending their people to testify before Congress. They're not going to be giving in documents that are required. There's going to be the Treasury Department is going to be doing whatever it can to hide access to Donald Trump's taxes. And now with William Barr, they're just not going to participate. And honestly, as I've been saying, I apologize if I sound like a bit of a broken record, but why would they? Why would you have William Barr testify when he could continue to commit perjury and there could at least hypothetically be consequences for that? Why would you hand in documents that could be used against you? Why would you do any of what has traditionally been required of the president and the White House and the executive branch more broadly when the Democrats have made clear that there will be no consequences whatsoever if you simply spurn all of their you know, calls to either regulations, laws, norms, any of it. Why would you? Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have made clear that all of this is going to be adjudicated in one way, if at all, and that is in November of 2020. They're going to leave it to the people to decide on all of this. And so why participate? Why pretend that there's a separation of powers when the power has been thrown in the trash? When Congress has said that they are not going to fulfill their constitutional obligations, why would the executive branch defer to them? I honestly don't know. I don't have, like, there's no happy end to this story. There is only fear for the precedent that is being set, that has been set in the immediate response to the Mueller report, in the belief that any conversation of impeachment should have nothing to do with the Constitution, nothing to do with underlying crimes, nothing to do with restoring any sense of honor and dignity to the White House, but everything to do with political considerations. I would say misconceived political considerations of how it would affect the 2020 election. That we are only going to think about one of the most important roles that the legislative branch can hold under our Constitution in holding our president accountable. All of that is going to be filtered 100% through purely partisan political considerations. That is my fear. And while I love, look, we're showing you a video right there of Kamala Harris sticking it to him, and Cory Booker looks somewhat motivated, although he did not similarly do a great job. It is to some extent just for show, because nothing will come of it. Kamala Harris can make him look terrible. She might even lead him into committing perjury, but there will be no charges. There will be no jail time. There will be nothing so long as the Democrats have decided that they will leave it to the people. The Constitution does not say that the people are supposed to adjudicate whether the president has committed something worthy of impeachment. It is very clear about who that's supposed to be. And I would say that the Mueller report was nearly as clear in its discussion of obstruction of justice. But from the point of view of the Democratic leadership, nope, too scary. They're too worried about what might happen. And so once again, they're going to allow crimes to be committed in the White House. They're going to set a precedent for more in the future. And all of us should be very worried about that. We're going to take one more break. We come back, we're going to turn to something a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more inspirational. Last night I watched Knock Down the House, and I'm going to give you my thoughts after this. Yesterday, the documentary Knock Down the House was made available on Netflix, and I want to give you my thoughts on it. But first, a bit from the trailer.
Crowley hasn't had a primary challenger in 14 years.
He's taken $3 million per cycle. He's going to tell me I'm small, that I'm young, that I'm inexperienced. My mom cleaned houses growing up. I never really saw myself going into politics. Americans aren't asking for a lot. They're just asking for politicians to help them get by. I can do this.
I know you can.
Okay, so I'm gonna guess that a lot of you watching this have probably watched that already. But if you haven't, you definitely should. It's available on Netflix. It obviously did very well at Sundance. It's a very interesting look at the campaign dynamics of the various primary challengers back in the 2018 cycle. Now, the reason that I enjoyed it so much was not just that it was focused on AOC, although that's a big part of it, but also for, like many of you probably, the daily grind of politics in a time when Donald Trump is president and the Supreme Court is conservative and the Senate is dominated by Republicans can be a depressing place. We all need a little bit of hope and a little bit of inspiration from time to time. And in the same way that primary challenge of AOC and her win in November provided that, and you know, watching her political activity since then has provided that, this documentary can do the same thing. Even though in three of the four cases that are profiled in this documentary, it does end in effectively tragedy. So you have AOC, but the three others are Paula Jean Swearengin of West Virginia, you have Cori Bush of Missouri, and Amy Vilela of Arizona. And in those three cases, they weren't successful, which is sad. And honestly, the experience of watching those sections can be heartbreaking when you see Paula Jean Swearengin. She's campaigning, talking about the effect that, you know, the obviously the environmental exploitation, energy exploitation, all of that, the effect it's had on the health of people in West Virginia is devastating. Amy Vilela talking about why she got into politics, the experience of her daughter dying because of the completely unjust healthcare industry that we have in this country. And then when she cries on election night, is devastating. From a personal point of view, it was even sadder because the video of her watching the race being called was me calling it on TYT. And I hadn't known that she had been watching it that night. And look, they all ran amazing campaigns. And they went up against, honestly, as much as I follow politics and as much as I follow these campaigns, and you know, Cenk and I on the main show, we covered every primary night. There was a lot of them, by the way. Even so, I had no idea in some of these cases how much they were up against it. Not just in terms of packed fields and trying to get fundraising, especially when rejecting corporate money and you know, big campaign donors and all of that. But in some cases, like with Cori Bush, going up against entrenched dynasties, basically. And that is what she had to go up against. And so in all of those, look, they fought like hell. And they're not done. They're going to be running again. And that is very exciting. I'm hoping to have those candidates on in the future. But it was hard to be reminded of how difficult it is. And a lot of what they experienced and sort of the story of the documentary that three lost but one won. There's a great quote from AOC in the documentary where she says, "It's just the reality that in order for one of us to make it through, 1,000 of us have to try." It's just, that's so powerful. And then we turn to AOC. And so the documentary does, I would say, disproportionately focus on AOC. I think that's understandable considering that she is the one of the four that won, but also because the documentary filmmakers, they didn't want you to be left with like a lack of hope and a tragedy and all of that. And they wanted to showcase that as big as the challenges are, there are candidates that are able to push through if there's enough effort and enough people trying. And so AOC did do that. And watching the experience of her from very early on, from the first meeting that she has with Justice Democrats and brand new Congress, when she realizes that she wants to do it, the like first times that she was knocking on doors, which you can see in her doing it, that as confident a speaker as she is shy on that level of knocking on a door. And I understand that. I've had to do a little bit of that and I absolutely hate it. It's the worst thing ever. But she does it and she fights through the ridiculous, weird legal challenges and all that are thrown up against her from the fact that Joe Crowley was not just her opponent, but was also the king of that machine in the area that she's running in. The nature of power and what you experience in challenging it, this documentary, I would say, does a better job of explaining that than anything I've seen in literally years. And I had not understood how much power Joe Crowley had over that entire apparatus. And I want to show you one other clip from the video because it's the day that she has her actual debate against Joe Crowley. He had already earlier on snubbed one and sent a surrogate, but she's actually going to talk to him and she's psyching herself up for it. And it just encapsulates for me so much of what I love about AOC. Here it is.
I am knowledgeable enough to do this. I am prepared enough to do this. I am mature enough to do this. I am brave enough to do this. And this whole thing, this whole time, he's going to tell me I can't do this. He's going to tell me I'm small, that I'm little, that I'm young, that I'm inexperienced.
And honestly, I think that I found my mantra now going forward. When I see the news and when I read the comments, just not today. Not today, okay? I need two things to get through this. I need AOC and I need Arya Stark. Those are the things, okay? And that is how we're going to change this country with people-powered campaign, progressive politics, and Valyrian steel, baby. But anyway, look, I'm joking. It is even her section, which is a triumph. And you get to relive the night when she realizes it, when she's trying to push into the bar where they're announcing that she's winning by saying, that's me on the poster. It's so powerful. And again, on a personal level, when she's talking about losing her father in college and how, you know, she hopes that she's making him proud, but he never gets to see her doing that. I experienced the same thing. My father passed away when I was in college. He had no notion that I would ever be in this career field at all, let alone, you know, what we would accomplish together. And so on a personal level, it's powerful. On a political level, it's powerful. And if you feel that you need some hope and some inspiration going into what is going to be a grueling 2020 campaign on the presidential and on the congressional level, I don't think that there's anything better right now than knock down the house. And so I would say you should definitely go see it if you haven't already seen it. You should watch it periodically if you have, because we are going to need it. Powerful stuff. Great job from the filmmakers. Okay, with that said, that's all the time that we have. Tomorrow, Brett Ehrlich is going to be joining me once again on the show. Got a lot of big stuff planned. So much news that we unfortunately weren't able to get to today. We will be talking about that tomorrow. So I will see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.